Shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
Good morning. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to our show today, Positively Healthy, here on KCNR 1460. And I want to introduce our guest. We have a caller on the line, and this is Dr. Peter Breggin. He's a psychiatrist. He's in private practice in Ithaca, New York. He's trained at Harvard Case Western Reserve Teaching Fellowship. He has taught at several universities. He's a medical expert in many cases. He's considered the conscience of psychiatry. And I became familiar with Dr. Breggin's work in 2008 when he wrote a book called Medication Madness, The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime. Also on the book, it says, there are hundreds of millions of psychiatric drugs prescriptions written annually. Are they doing more harm than good? And I want to welcome Dr. Peter Breggin to the show today. Welcome, doctor.
Oh, very good to be with you, Trudy. Very good to be with you.
Oh, it's so nice to have you. You know, I looked at the weather today in Ithaca, and I thought I was going to say something like it's 0 degrees, but hey, it looks pretty good to me.
You know, it's a myth about how bad the weather is in where we are in upstate New York. We're just a little south of the snow belt here in Ithaca.
Yeah, it looks great.
And the weather tends to be, you know, definitely livable and gorgeous, gorgeous in the spring, summer, and fall. So we live well. I'm looking out at Lake Cayuga right now, out my windows of my office, my home office.
Oh, wonderful. Gosh, well, that sounds nice and soothing.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. You know, there's so much going on, and I just want to sort of kick off our talking here. We're going to kind of remove a couple of our commercials because there's just so much to have you teach us. And I want to start right off with, you know, what we all want to talk about. We want to talk about that darn shooting and how it's translated into a gun issue, and there's not a whole lot of questions happening with drugs, drug interactions, medications, amounts of medications, increases in doses, decreases in doses, and what happens to people. And I want to just sort of kick off with that topic. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Well, so we had this shooting, and, I mean, based on your experience and your entire life of asking questions, what questions were we forgetting?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that right after the shooting in Connecticut, the next 2 days, it was like a shot of truth serum into the talking heads on CNN and Fox. And they actually raised questions which I've never heard brought up before in the major media.
Mm.
Sanjay Gupta, you know, who's sort of America's physician on CNN, he's a neurosurgeon. He was going to be the Surgeon General, but he preferred his work, you know, with being a neurosurgeon, being on CNN. And he's a very establishment guy. I mean, he's really establishment. And he, right after the shootings, I caught him on TV and managed to capture it and put it on my website. I caught him saying at length that we were going to have to find out about the role that psychiatric drugs, particularly antidepressants, may have played in the violence in Connecticut.
Hmm.
And that we were really establishing that connection, which was just an incredible thing. And he talked about that for a couple of minutes. And then on Fox, on the other poll, Tom Ridge, who's the former head of Homeland Security and a panel member on the Virginia Tech shootings investigation, a man really in on the know, again said, you know, we've got to look into psychiatric drugs and whether they had an effect in Connecticut and learn more about that because, he said, some evaluations, and I think he's probably referring to me, some evaluations show that there was a role for the SSRI, the antidepressants, SSRIs they're called, the newer ones like Prozac and Luvox and Paxil and Zoloft, that there's a role for them, there was a role for them in Eric Harris's shooting at Columbine. I mean, this is incredible. I captured that too. I wrote a blog and I got the links to the, to those segments from the TV. But there was never again a mention of anything like that. It was like that one shot of truth serum from the horror of what had happened just spilled out of these guys' mouths. And as far as I know, no major network in any of their big discussions now of the shootings, including CNN and Fox, has ever come back to that issue.
Right. Now, why is that?
Well, there is active suppression that goes on. I've gotten calls from officials in various states who have should have the right to the information about their local shootings, including Connecticut. And they're calling me to see if I have any information because they can't get it. The drug companies, Organized Medicine and Psychiatry, National Institute of Mental Health, this makes up, and also the National Institutes of Health, this makes up, Trudy, one of the most powerful, if not the single most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., and one of the major forces in our society today, maybe in some ways the biggest cultural force in our society. And over the years, they have managed, and I can't tell you how exactly, to shut down all reporting about these mass murderers. And the only cases that I know about in detail, and where there are details, as far as I know, are the ones where I've been a medical expert, and I can tell you a little bit about that.
Okay.
But most of the shootings, there's this information around almost every single one of them that the person was involved with psychiatry, the person was involved with drugs, but we don't have the details like you were asking about, you know, what drug, how much, when, were there dose changes, which are usually problematic. That just crushed. And just one last word about Trudy. This is developed over the years. Back in 2000 and, rather in back in 1994, when my wife and I wrote Talking Back to Prozac, when Ginger was my co-author, we wrote Talking Back to Prozac, we were able to find innumerable newspaper reports linking various horrible events to Prozac, terrible car accidents, terrible murders, violent suicides.
And what year was this, roughly?
It disappeared. There are no more media links to that stuff.
Okay, that was 1994, you said, roughly?
Yeah.
Okay.
In those few years, reports came pouring out in the media. And then I saw afterward that very often I'd know there was a drug linked to a violent crime, and I knew that the newspapers had access to the information, and they wouldn't make the link.
So this is basically overt censorship.
Oh, gosh, there's no doubt about it at all. I'll give you one of the most egregious examples. A couple of years ago, USA did a big feature story on the anniversary of the Columbine shootings. And it said, we now know one thing, looking back in retrospect, Eric Harris was not taking antidepressants. This said it. So I wrote them a letter, and I said, hey, I was an expert in cases surrounding Eric Harris. I saw the medical records. Here is the way you obtain the company report to the FDA. Salve was the company that distributed Luvox, which was what he was on. Luvox is very much like Prozac. I said, here's the report showing very ironically that the autopsy found, quote, a therapeutic level. It's so ironic, meaning an active level of the drug in the body of Eric Harris at the time of his death. And here is also an autopsy report, the original autopsy report, showing the same thing. I said, I've seen his medical records, so I can verify he was taking Luvox for a full year before the attacks on Columbine High. I can verify that his records show that he was an obsessive kid, but no evidence of a really disturbed, violent, crazy person, and that as the year goes on, his own writings get crazier and crazier. And I can tell you that Luvox has a very high percentage of mania in young boys and girls, that in fact in the controlled clinical trials, which are usually, you know, you don't see a lot of horror in just those short little trials, 4% of the Luvox youngsters develop mania. So we've got all the links in the world we need. And I wrote this to USA Today as a correction. And, of course, they not only didn't print it, they never even got in touch with me. That's active suppression.
Certainly. And then where are we? So if we just decide that we can't get clear information about medication, I want to hear what you know based on your experience and your research. What do we know about these medications? What should I know? What should my neighbors know?
Well, there's no question at all that three groups of psychiatric drugs cause violence. No question at all about it, and I believe that if we looked at it further, all groups of psychiatric drugs and all groups of psychoactive substances of any strength have that potential. But the recent study examined all the reports to the FDA for all drugs, everything, smoking aids, drugs for, pneumonia and heart disease, and, you know, all the prescription drugs from the FDA, and they found that the vast majority, like I think it was 85%, had 0 to 2 reports of a violent act. That is, there was no real violence associated with them. And then they found that three groups of psychiatric drugs had a huge association. One was the SSRI antidepressants, like mm-hmm. Prozac and Zoloft and Celexa and Paxil and Lexapro and so on. And the rate of violence was more than 800% greater per prescription for those drugs. Then the next group were benzodiazepine tranquilizers like Xanax. And I would add, just my huge clinical experience in forensic, that the combination of Xanax and antidepressants is really deadly. And the third group are the stimulants we give to children. So then you say, well, you know, these are disturbed people. Well, there's two ways of looking at that to show it isn't the people who are getting the drugs, it's the drugs. One is that the worst drug of all was actually the smoke aid Chantix. It is the most associated with violent behavior of any drug. Well, that's just smokers. As smokers across the board. So they're certainly not an especially violent group. And furthermore, the drugs most commonly given to the most violent people, the most disturbed people, the antipsychotic drugs like Haldol and Seroquel and Abilify and so on, did not have a particularly high rate of reports of violence. So I think it just buttons it right on down that the problem here is psychiatric drugs causing violence. And you mentioned my book, Medication Madness. I've got 50 cases that I look into in depth in that book where I've seen the medical records, interviewed families, interviewed survivors, and have shown clearly what we should know anyway, but more in a story form, although they're totally accurate stories, that psychiatric drugs commonly cause violence, suicide, mayhem, mania, crime. And it's really a dreadful, overlooked situation, Trudy. Just very important.
Now, are the clinical trials just kind of, I mean, they're very short for starters, but are they getting poor results during the clinical trials and it's suppressed, or are the clinical trials just basically sponsored fake research?
Yes.
Okay.
The clinical trials are basically fake sponsored research. The way it's done is the trials, for example, for Prozac, most of them were supposed to last only 6 weeks, and they couldn't even get past 4 weeks for most of them because so many patients dropped out because of these terrible adverse effects from the Prozac. So you have these very short trials to begin with. They're not looking for violence, and they're not looking for suicide. They're trying not to find violence and suicide. They're trying to find improvement. And who does the trials? Well, basically, it's all drug company run. Now, well, what about the scientists that conduct the trials? The scientists are just names, you know, Joe Blow from the University of whatever, and he's a big professor. But what is he actually doing? Nothing. His nurses in his clinic are seeing the patients and passing the patients through and collecting the data. And then where does the data go? It doesn't even go to Joe Blow. It goes right to the drug company head office where they analyze his data. Then there's a paper written. Who writes the paper? Not Joe Blow, the professor. The paper's written by, most of the time, the paper is written by people employed by the drug companies. And it's twisted and it's combed and it's pruned until it comes out positive to the drug company. So if you can't, as a drug company, get your paid people to come up with a positive study after doing, say, six, you can do as many as you want. All you got to do is come up with two remotely positive studies, just something that passes statistical significance for some kinds of improvement behavior. If you can't do that, you don't know what you're doing.
And yet, the FDA holds these drugs out as safe.
Well, the FDA is supposed to meet the standard of safe and effective, that the drug is safe and effective. But the FDA itself, in its more honest moments, and I have a lot of quotes about this in my more basic science book called Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. I have a lot of quotes from FDA people over the years in which they say, hey, we can't get anywhere near all the adverse effects. We can't even get some of the most disastrous and important adverse effects in studies that are lasting only a few weeks or more. It's just impossible. We've got to have the drug out there in the public, on the market. And the truth is that many psychiatric drugs are taken off the market after they've been out for months and even years and decades. They get taken off the market. So it's no easy matter to detect all of these adverse effects, even when they cause death. And since the drug companies are, in my experience, everyone I've dealt with, desperately trying to hide very serious effects, sometimes they never come out.
How effective would you say these drugs are? I mean, we all know people who got a lot of help when they went on fill-in-the-blank medication. And what do you have to say for those people who have had success?
Well, the first thing I want to say is, when listening to me, remember that it's not only very dangerous to start any psychoactive substance of any strength, like a psychiatric drug, it's also very dangerous to stop them, because both the starting, the stopping, the changing the doses jerks the brain around. The brain doesn't have a chance to accommodate, and pretty soon you're a victim of your own brain because the chemistry is so out of whack. So be careful about coming off drugs. It needs to be done slowly, hopefully with experienced clinical supervision, the involvement of your friends. And that's my latest book, of course. My latest book is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. The first half of it talks about the dangers of the drugs, and the second half of Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal talks about how to get off the drugs. Now, as to their effectiveness, it's very hard to show that any psychiatric drug is effective even in the short term.
Okay.
There's a recent, several studies now over the years where instead of just looking at the two studies that the drug companies cherry pick to use to prove effectiveness to the FDA, if you look at all the studies that they did to get those two, let's say they'd done six, and the FDA has those six studies, but only two were used for effectiveness. And you look at those six, that is, you look at all the studies submitted to the FDA for antidepressants, and they don't work. They're no better than placebo. And that's astonishing, because, in fact, usually doctors and patients can tell whether they're on placebo or antidepressant. They can tell because they're getting effects from the antidepressant. They may be getting stomach aches or headaches or insomnia or agitation or sleepiness or just all kinds of different things, whereas they're getting not much effects at all from the placebo. Despite that, you still can't show that the antidepressants work. One study showed that for extremely depressed people, there was a slight statistically significant improvement on the antidepressants. Slight, but it wasn't clinically significant. So what's going on is simply that whether you take a placebo or an antidepressant, you're going to tend to feel better because they both give hope.
Yeah.
They both give you a sense of fresh start. They both give you, that idea that you can get better. But it's so much better to get that idea in terms of changing your life and strengthening yourself and becoming self-determining and finding strength in family or God or nature. I mean, all that's so much healthier than imagining placebo, you know,
right.
Imagining it's from the drug.
And what about drug interactions?
Well,
I mean, it just seems like
studied very much.
Right, right. I feel like people get lost somewhere in the interactions.
Oh, that's a very good way to put it, Trudy. People do. They get lost in the interactions. I mean, when you're on 4 or 5 psychiatric drugs, or even 3, and often if you're just on 2, you're an experiment because there aren't any studies. It's just what clinicians think, what their own experience tells them, which is not very useful in this arena of where everybody's pushing drugs.
Right.
So think of it this way, which maybe gives the public a real concept of how crazy this is. I'll see a patient who, let's say, has committed violence or attempted suicide, or I'm evaluating a suicide case, or it's one of my own people come to me as a patient, and they're on 5 psychiatric drugs. Well, they are on the maximum dose of each drug. Now, the clinician, the psychiatrist, the pediatrician, the internist, the OBGYN, whoever put the person on these drugs, thinks, well, that's fine. I'm giving the allowable maximum dose of the drug. But when the allowable maximum dose of the drug was determined, it was determined on the basis of you're not getting it.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It was determined, that maximum dose was determined on the basis of one drug alone. So it's like saying, Your Honor, I wasn't drunk. I had the maximum level of bourbon.
Oh,
I had
the
maximum level of beer. Oh, yeah, I was taking a maximum level of Xanax. I wasn't impaired. Oh, I was smoking the maximum level of dope. I'm not impaired. Well, that's ridiculous. But doctors routinely give 3 or 4 or 5 drugs at their maximum levels thinking it's safe.
Oh, my gosh. Now, are drug companies, are they protected from lawsuits?
No, the drug companies are not protected from lawsuits. I mean, there's a lot of legal things that go back and forth about how much you can hold drug companies responsible. But basically, the one of the most basic issues is do the warnings in the label adequately cover what the physician needs to know?
Okay.
And a lot of my own work has made it impossible on some issues to sue the companies. My work, you know, was very instrumental in getting the drug companies to put these lengthy warnings in their labels, these warnings in the labels look very much like an article I wrote just before the labels came out, and I know that article was given to every single member of the FDA's panel that was making the recommendations. It was given to them in a not very large packet. I mean, there weren't a lot of articles in that packet, so they all got to see my article. And the warnings now have a lot of stuff in them that I've been saying for years for antidepressants about causing aggressivity and hostility and impulsivity and hypomania and mania and all this stuff that I've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah.
So now it's hard to sue the drug companies when a patient gets one of those things because the warnings are in there. The doctor should have warned the patient. And the same thing happened with tardive dyskinesia, which is a terrible disorder of bodily movement that you get from the antipsychotic drugs like Geodone and Seroquel and Zyprexa and Risperdal and the older ones like Haldol. This movement disorder, in 1985, the FDA upgraded the warnings, largely as a result of a book I wrote and that was on a major TV. They felt compelled to reevaluate. So now it's hard to sue the drug companies when a patient gets tardive dyskinesia, this disease from drugs, because the warnings are there. But the drug companies never really get around to adequately describing how dangerous the drugs are. In fact, it just occurred to me talking to you that one area to begin looking at with these drug companies is that when they write down the maximum dose level for their drug, they never put in, keep in mind, this was determined on one drug alone, not on the person being on many drugs. So that could be another area to hold these people responsible for.
Oh, it sounds like it. You know, I want to ask you some questions about you. A lot of people are psychiatrists, and they sort of do their training, and they follow the company line. And somewhere, some part of you, the critical thinker in you, said, hey, this doesn't sound right. Have you always been that way? I mean, tell us how you became this person.
Excuse me. Well, Trudy, it started very, very, very early. I was 18 years old. I was a freshman at Harvard. A friend of mine said, you're studying too hard. I was in an honors program for American history and literature, probably going to be a professor. And he said, you're studying too hard. Come on out and volunteer at the mental hospital. Get out of yourself and your studies. So I went out to this state hospital, and it was 1954. That's how far back I go.
Good.
And I was appalled by what I saw. I was shocked. It reminded me of my Uncle Dutch's descriptions of liberating a Nazi extermination camp. The brutality toward the patients, the abject misery that they lived in, the horrible ways that were being brutalized with lobotomy and electroshock and poisonous drugs. It was just terrible. And I became a leader of the program. I actually started my first book in college. And it got published shortly after as some of the other students also joined in to co-author it. And I was, all of a sudden, I was doing things on a national level, getting national media for this program, our volunteer program, showing that we could get patients out of the hospital.
Wow.
I found out that I set up a program as a college kid where 12 of us got our own patients, and the hospital was very worried about this, but we had a wonderful social worker who supervised us in a group once a week. And we ended up, instead of, quote, hurting the patients like the psychiatrists were warning, we ended up getting them, almost all of them, out of the hospital.
Huh.
Totally unexpected.
Oh, my gosh.
So I learned from the get-go that first what was called psychiatric treatment was doing much more harm than good. And second, I learned that what people really needed was caring relationship, and that the more disturbed the patient was, the more they need basic caring relationship. And so that's how I got started in psychiatry. It's why I became a pre-medical student. It's why I went to medical school. But by the time I got out of medical school and into my residency, everywhere psychiatry was making a political change. Psychiatry had discovered that doing psychotherapy, which some psychiatrists did, doing social psychiatry, where you tried to improve society, which some psychiatrists did, doing community psychiatry, where you worked in the local communities to make things better, which, again, some psychiatrists did. There are even training programs in community psychiatry and social psychiatry. Well, that was gone now, because what happened was it became obvious that if you were going to do community psychiatry, social psychiatry, psychotherapy psychiatry, you didn't need to be a psychiatrist. You could be a social worker. You could be a psychologist. You could be a community activist. You could be all kinds of things. You didn't need to be a psychiatrist to do psychosocial things. So the psychiatrists faced a bleak future. And so they got together, and I trace this in my book, my older book, Toxic Psychiatry. I trace the minutes of the American Psychiatric Association board, actual board meeting, to show that this was conscious. They decided that since they were going to go broke, trying to compete with psychologists and social workers and marriage and family counselors, that they had to become a partner with the psychopharmaceutical industry and do the one thing all those other people couldn't, which is prescribe, prescribe, prescribe. And so by the time I got out into the arena of psychiatry, there was no role for the person doing reform work in society or the person doing psychosocial interventions and psychological interventions. So I had to kind of reinvent myself as the person I became. And the key turning point was I went into private practice, and I thought, well, then I'll do what I never thought I'd do. I thought I'd be a professor or the youngest head of the Psychiatric Association ever or something like that. Instead, I went into private practice, which I love and still do. And then I found out lobotomy was coming back. And I said, wait a minute. We've got all this promotion for lobotomy. We've got dozens of places doing lobotomy in Europe and North America. And I said, I'm going to do something about it. And so I began an international campaign to stop lobotomy. And that's when I became a reformer. And that's when I became under attack. I could not believe that the Psychiatric Association was going to attack violently a young psychiatrist who happened to be a member of their association because he was against lobotomy. And I became the first psychiatrist to stand up publicly against lobotomy. Then I became the first psychiatrist ever to stand up in public against electroshock. Eventually, I became the first psychiatrist. And it's so interesting that this profession is so suppressive that I had to wait all this time for one person to dare do this. I also now am the first psychiatrist to ever be a medical expert in a psychosurgery lobotomy case that was won in court, and the first electroshock case that was won in court. So that's how controlling the profession had been all those years, that it took all that time for one young man to come along, and now an older, much older man to come along and say, I'm going to take a stand on these issues.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you for being such a go-against-the-grain type person. So,
well, it's a go for the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Now,
you know, it's the lies that are against the grain.
Very good. Thank you for straightening me out. So what is it in us that makes us think we need these drugs? What is it? Is it the direct-to-consumer advertising? Is it, I mean, what happens to us? Where did we become not quite okay? Or where did we just start believing that we weren't okay, where we decided we wanted to reach for a pill instead of maybe work out a problem?
Well, there's two things going on. One is human nature and culture in general, but the driving force behind it all, the driving force that appeals to human vulnerability and weakness, is the profits of the drug companies. They did not unleash themselves on society until the benzodiazepines came along, and it was found that these sedatives, very little different from older sedatives like phenobarbital, that these sedatives, all addictive, could be marketed as something new and special for anxiety, and you get Mother's Little Helper and the years of Valium and the huge numbers of women addicted, mm-hmm. and men, of course, but really marketed at women. And that was the beginning of taking the methods of psychiatry that mainly were used in state hospitals, that is, drugging people, and going into the public with them. And then the most brilliant ad campaign of all time, you know, was the Prozac curing a biochemical imbalance when there is no biochemical imbalance in depressed people, and when Prozac causes biochemical imbalances, doesn't correct them. So incredible successful campaign. So a huge amount of this is the drug companies, the billions with which they buy medical schools, you know, they build buildings on the medical schools and named them after the drug companies, bought the Psychiatric Association, which was very eager to be bought, the medical societies, the journals, and on.
They're all addicted to drug money, right?
They really have this huge, huge conglomerate selling this idea to people.
Absolutely.
Meanwhile, Judy, people are vulnerable. Human beings have always been vulnerable to feeling desperate and overwhelmed and wanting an easier way out. That's always been a part of us. It's a part of me. It's probably a part of you. It's probably a part of all of our listeners. We'd like some relief. God bless us. Life is very hard. So there's that human vulnerability, but it's the drive of the drug companies in cooperation with organized medicine that's at the root of how bad it's gotten.
And you have a type of training that you have started called empathic training, and it's called empathictherapy.org for anyone who, any of our listeners. And tell us about what you've learned and what you're teaching others.
Yeah, and you know, I forget to mention this all the time. We have our annual meeting. It's been annual for a few years anyway, and it's coming up at the end of April.
Okay.
It's April 28th, which is a 26th, which is a Friday, April 26th, and Saturday, and then half-day Sunday, starting on April 26th, Friday. It's in Syracuse, New York. We almost filled last year. We have a capacity for a little over 200. And we have people from around the world who come and talk about, and you can get to this, as you mentioned, Trudy, at empathictherapy.org. And if you don't get the spelling right, my wife pretty much has it all covered, and you'll get there one way or another.
Okay.
But empathictherapy.org. Just put in Bregan Empathy, and you'll get there. And our organization, it brings together people that have two shared viewpoints. One part of the viewpoint is that diagnosing and drugging people is scientifically and morally incorrect.
Hmm. Okay.
And the other part is that that the starting point of all human service, of all therapy, of all help, of all human service, is empathy. Caring about the other person, understanding the other person's viewpoint, seeing through their eyes what they need and what would help, and trying to be that helping person in whatever area you're trying to help in, whether it's therapy or social services or the law or medicine. All good human service, teaching, all good human services start with empathy. And that's what this conference is about. And I have an empathic therapy training film, which is selling really well, part because we make it so cheap. It's not one of these $200 films, but a $300 or $500, though it could be. It's really affordable. You can get it on Bregan.com. But we're trying not to create a new therapy, but to emphasize in whatever approach you are taking to helping people, including various kinds of therapy, including teaching, whatever it is, medical care. I've given lectures to physicians on empathy and medical care, that empathy is the starting point. It's the absolute starting point. So that's what we're about.
So looking at a human being who is suffering in any way and showing support, and even if you aren't in their shoes, this feeling of understanding, of a connection, a human connection, that you're understanding their position a little bit. I'm trying to kind of reiterate empathy.
Yeah.
What is the definition of empathy?
You know, I don't even like defining it because it's like defining love.
Yeah.
I think empathy is an aspect of love.
Okay.
To start with, love is treasuring. Love is reverence. Love is deeply caring. Love is actual joy that we feel on knowing another human being.
Hmm.
And empathy emphasizes that aspect of love where you understand the other person in a real deep way. You don't necessarily feel their suffering, but you grasp it and you get it. And you can communicate to that person that you're there with them with what they're going through. And I'll give you a real example, right, just out of my work. Recently, I I saw a husband and wife. The husband had been subjected to horrendous electroshock treatment, and he was very damaged by the treatment. Really has what's called dementia, a global injury to his brain and mind, and still incredibly depressed and still angry, very angry and upset, but unable to communicate. And they had been to multiple doctors. And my simply talking to them at the start, I stopped at one point and said, you know, I'm taking notes because I need them for this evaluation, but I hate to do it. I hope it doesn't make me seem indifferent. And they both started to cry. The man who had such injury could still cry, and they said, we feel that you understand.
Hmm.
And then later on, the man opened his heart to me, talking alone, how he didn't want to be angry, and he didn't understand why he was angry. For one thing, he couldn't remember his previous life from the shock treatment. And then we got together and talked about his letting go of his anger, and it was just incredibly touching. So that sort of describes a bit of what empathy is about in action, and, you know, in my own work.
Right. My gosh. Was there a time when the human race was more empathic?
Oh, God. I don't know the answer to that. I think, you know, I'm Jewish,
mm-hmm.
but I think the real turning point was Jesus. You know, I think that the real turning point was the whole idea of love one another, love God, love one another, and the theme that is earlier in Judaism and so much more, I think, crystallized in what Jesus had to say, but it's also in Buddhism, it's in most religions, is this do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And it's not perfect, do unto others. I mean, it really should be more like do unto others as they would really wish you to do to them, not how you'd like to be done to. But it's all very complicated,
yeah.
This business of life. But I think the turning point was a spiritual one. Up until the slow developments within Judaism and then in Christianity, there was no real concept in civilization that love should rule rather than power.
Huh, okay.
And I think that intellectuals, you know, miss the boat when they're not willing to look at the impact of the Sermon on the Mount. And they're not willing to look at the best of what the disciples had to say about these issues, because I really think that was a big turning point in history.
In history,
so,
yeah.
I think that, in fact, in terms of civilization, there's been more understanding and knowledge about that than ever before. And right now, the concept of empathy and caring, I'm just getting huge responses to everywhere I go and speak or on the radio, TV, huge responses. So was there a better time, prehistoric?
We won't know, right?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes. And,
well,
and under such pressures as prehistoric people lived, I would think that, you know, empathy held together the little tribes and the people in caves and in tribes on the pampas and whatever. But under such pressure, you know, there was certainly empathy always within the family, but maybe not much further extended.
Okay.
That.
Well, because you have seen a lot, you've been with our country for a lot of years now, and so you get to reflect back. And you can see clearer back than we can. And so in the last 30, 20, 10, 5, 2, 3, 1, what are we like? You know, what are Americans like? What are we in need of? What are we blocked by?
Well, we get into really controversial areas here, but I'll handle it as lightly and generally as I can.
Okay.
I don't think love can be forced, and empathy.
Okay.
I think it grows from individual values. And I think we need much more emphasis on personal responsibility and independence, because love doesn't flow from forced sharing. Love flows from each person coming to grips with what does it mean to take charge of your own life and to become a loving person.
That's profound.
Huh?
That's profound.
We have a little glitch in my phone.
Oh, okay. I was saying...
You said that's profound.
Yeah, I said that's profound. Yeah.
I deeply believe that. And I believe that, and I see it in raising kids and in other people raising kids, every person has to deal with this on their own, regardless of how they've been raised, whether they've been loved, unloved, whether it's been a mixed picture, like for almost everybody. Well, for everybody, it's a mixed picture growing up. You yourself have to decide, how do I want to live? Do I want to say, I'm responsible for myself, and I'm responsible for the people I love, and I'm going to behave in a certain kind of way and find that strength somewhere, whether it's from my loved ones, from God, from nature, from special talents or creativity, that I'm going to find that strength to be a source of love. I think that's what it's ultimately about.
Hmm. Now, you wrote a book also that I'd like our listeners to know. It's called Wow, I'm an American, How to Live Like Our Nation's Heroic Founders. Now, I haven't had a chance to really look through that book, so tell me about that book.
Well, it's really interesting. It's so out of my area that I didn't even know how to get an agent or publisher for it. And my wife came to the rescue by creating a publishing company and completely producing this gorgeous book.
Hmm.
It's basically, it looks at the lives of the founders, what they went through during the revolution, and draws out of it what can we learn about ourselves today and how to live. I haven't put a lot of emphasis on it because our culture right now is so violently divided that when I talk like that, a lot of people who might otherwise pay attention to my reform work get so mad at me for my sort of fundamental belief in the founding values of the country that they don't pay any attention to my reform work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my mission is probably, what I'm probably here on earth for, as best as I can tell, is for what no one's done before me, which is this... taking on the drug companies and psychiatry and scientifically and morally and politically. So, but you're bringing up what my heart is about ultimately. It's about how do we live as people.
Right.
You're right tuned into it.
Well, I mean, in order to not start reaching for a prescription, we have to start figuring out what is that uncomfortable feeling in there.
Exactly.
And that's always right. A little scarier than getting the lid off of a pill bottle.
Well, and one of the worst things about the modern psychiatric viewpoint, which, by the way, is pushed by psychotherapists now, social workers, psychologists, no matter who you go to for help, your teacher, your rabbi, your minister, or if you tell them you're really depressed and really suicidal, they're not going to look at you and say, well, that's what education's about. It's about finding meaning in life, or that's what God's about, you know, if you're a minister or a priest or whatever. No, they can say go to the psychiatrist. So what does it mean in terms of responsibility? It means that every psychiatrist with every diagnosis and every drug is teaching us we can't manage our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
That our brains, whether given by evolution or God or both, that our brains, us as beings, the whole us, cannot manage and grow and triumph in life. That we have these defects that require drugs.
Hmm.
And so psychiatry and all the docs giving drugs and the social workers and therapists referring people to doctors for drugs, they're all undermining the foundation of this country and the foundation of every good life, which is I have within myself to take charge of my life. I may be confused. I may get misguided. But when I get it straight, I have within myself the power to take charge of my own life.
Hmm. How can that not be a place of self-responsibility and empowerment?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Well, you're getting a lot out of me.
I know.
I never talk about.
You're sharing so much, and I'm just so honored, and I'm learning so much. And it always starts to come back to we're all okay the way we are, and if we can open our hearts up a little bit more to that loving place and live from that, huh? That's just like a teaching of life. And you have had quite a journey getting there and getting to that place and sharing that, right? I mean, that's that's profound. And so
and everybody has to work to get to their own special viewpoint expressed in their own way. It isn't, it just isn't there to be grabbed, you know. It's an individual work that we can do, and it's we can share and we can give and we can love, but it starts with each of us as individuals.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I'm going to head back to some topics here that I know people wanted me to ask you. And so, and I want to come back to this, direct-to-consumer advertising. And do you ever see that being outlawed?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. There's no doubt it does a lot of damage. We're one of the very few countries in the world that allows direct-to-consumer advertising of drugs. But I'm ambivalent about it, believe it or not, because I do believe in liberty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So my view is, you know, that we need, that we shouldn't start outlawing what people can advertise and say, and but we better hold them responsible for telling the truth. Hold them responsible for telling the truth.
Fair enough, yeah.
And that's where the legal system comes into play. You know, the one way, the best way I know to hold people responsible is not with government regulation, which, because they always get to be partners, they go to bed together with the people they regulate, because the people they regulate have so much money, so they don't end up regulating half as much as they end up prostituting themselves with the regulatory agencies. You know, I think the most powerful thing we still have is the right to sue these companies when they behave in a fraudulent manner. And in my experience, which is mostly in the psychiatric drug arena, there's always an element of fraud because these drugs don't work.
Right.
So they got to be doing something fraudulent to get them out into the public the way they do. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of harm from the direct-to-consumer advertising, but I don't think we want to start outlawing things like that.
Okay, that sounds very clear.
But it's a complex.
Yeah.
And people can disagree.
In our last couple of minutes here, what's our future? What does it look like? When you look way ahead for us, what do you see from where you're perched?
Well, the momentum right now is shifting a little bit away from drugging, especially in regard to the elderly and in regard to children. There's a lot more recognition that this is really terrible. I'm doing so much more media than I've done in years, and it's always positive. You know, one's going to come along that's negative. One's going to come along that's negative one of these days, I presume, and I'm ready for that. But I've just been getting such positive media. So the times are changing, but what's going to happen in the future? I don't know. I can tell you that the only thing that's going to stop, ultimately stop, this huge drugging of our culture, so that more than 20% of women at any one time are on antidepressants, so probably a quarter of our kids before they're done get diagnosed and drugged for at least a brief period of time. I mean, probably 12% are on right now. I mean, we don't have very good, maybe 15%. We don't have very good estimates, but they're huge numbers. Only thing that's going to stop it is folks saying no.
Excellent.
That is getting the word out, people learning about this, and people learning that it is time to stop taking our children and ourselves to psychiatrists when we have emotional problems, that we're just going to get drugs, and to the GPs, and to the OBGYNs, that we're just going to get drugs. And another group I'm working with, by the way, is called Mother Bear Can. Mother Bear, and then C-A-N.
Okay.
Ginger and I are both on their advisory council, and they're trying to bring in basic family values to give support to families who have trouble.
We're going to break here, I guess. I guess I lost track of time a little bit. But
I think you did.
I got so involved.
Like, we're done, I think.
We're in our last 20 seconds here. Hey, I want to thank you for coming on today. I learned so much. I had moments where I was speechless, which is strange for me. And so thank you so much, Dr. Bregan. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me on and getting me to talk from the heart more than I do usually.
Oh, good. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. Washington's latest debt-cutting deadline is at the top of the to-do list for President Obama.
These cuts don't have to happen.
He was talking about next week's sequester, the budget cuts required by an earlier debt compromise.
Mr. President, it takes more than a soundbite to get the economy going.
Senator John Hoeven of North Dakota in the Republicans' Saturday speech.
President Obama is trying to turn up the heat on Republicans, saying all it would take is a little compromise to avoid those $85 billion in spending cuts.
Are they seriously prepared to inflict more pain on the middle class because they refuse to ask anything more of those at the very top?
Republicans say they're ready to compromise.
The right way to address our deficit and debt and get past the sequester is not higher taxes or just better spending control. It's by creating jobs.
President Obama will continue to take his message on the road next week with a stop at a Virginia shipbuilding operation.
Fox's Molly Henneberg in Washington. Iran's